This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Angeline Echeverria, I should say, spent the first 14 years of her life in upstate New York. Her parents emigrated from Cuba. She knew her family was different from others in her community, but didn't really start to understand racism until she moved to South Carolina. She noticed that white and black families lived near each other but stayed apart, and Angeline, with her light skin tone, was considered part of the white community. Her effort to sort out the complexities of racism led her to a life of social activism. When she was in high school, she volunteered for Amnesty International. Then she traveled to Costa Rica and New York, and in April moved to North Carolina to become the executive director of El Pueblo, a Latino advocacy organization. Angeline Echeverria joins us right now in the studio. Welcome. It's good to have you on the program.
Thanks for inviting me.
Tell us about the mission of El Pueblo. What was the organization set up to do?
So originally, El Pueblo was founded with a broad mission of strengthening the Latino community. I think that when El Pueblo was founded, it was at a time that really the boom of Latino immigrants to North Carolina was really starting to be felt.
And when was that?
We were founded in 1995. Yeah. And so I think that we explored a number of different strategies for, you know, addressing the needs of the Latino community. We've run health programs over the year, youth programs, programs related to public safety. But one of the things that El Pueblo really built a reputation for was being an advocacy organization. We were among one of the first groups to actually have someone focusing on what was going on in the General Assembly, spreading that information to other organizations throughout the state. And also, at a time, we served as kind of a technical assistance provider, helping other Latino organizations that were being founded in different regions of the state to develop, to incorporate, and to address some of the concerns that they had locally. Over the last couple of years, we've gone through a transition, and right now we're really trying to figure out what is our value added to the movement here in North Carolina. I think that over the past couple of years, we haven't been as active in terms of advocacy, and other organizations have stepped up and have started participating more in that arena. So right now, we're really looking at how we refocus our mission. How is our type of advocacy different from, say, the type of advocacy maybe that the ACLU does or other groups that are more driven by lawyers or policymakers? Because really our model is a community-based advocacy model, which is just a little bit different, and it's not something that everybody necessarily understands at first hand.
Now, El Pueblo went through some leadership problems just over the past few years, was without an executive director, lost its funding. Describe some of that. What was going on there?
So the last time we had a full-time executive director on staff was in 2010. And during this transition process, we had a collaborative leadership team whereby certain members of the staff took on additional responsibilities. And Pablo Escobar, who was our board treasurer, stepped up. And most people saw him as the interim executive director, although he would be really clear that it was a team effort. That was something that was really challenging to have other organizations and folks in the community to understand. So I was just hired last month, and I am really looking forward to moving forward with the great team that, of the staff at El Pueblo.
How do you see the strength of El Pueblo right now? You talked about trying to refine the mission a little bit and see what it is that you're uniquely situated to do. At this moment, I know you're new, and I know you're going to want to talk with a lot of people in the group. What's your sense, your personal sense and your sense from those who have been part of this about where El Pueblo should go?
So if you talk to people outside of El Pueblo about what El Pueblo does, the two things they're going to tell you is that we have a fiesta every year, the Fiesta del Pueblo, which actually predates the organization. So it really makes sense that that continues to be a core aspect that people recognize us for. And then if they know anything more about El Pueblo, they'll tell you we're an advocacy organization. So I think that our challenge right now is identifying how each one of our programs ties into an advocacy mission. How are we actually engaging community members, whether it's through our youth programs, our health programs, or cultural activities, to become advocates on their own behalf, right? How are we developing spokespeople? How are we giving people the tools and information that they need in order to be able to advocate on their own behalf, not just in the General Assembly, but in other aspects of their life as well?
Now, how much of this is going to be a kind of remediation? I mean, there were El Pueblo lost its funding for part of that time that you're talking about. Why did that happen? What was going on there? And how much of your mission is going to be to restore the reputation of El Pueblo?
I think that we have lost funding from a number of different sources and for a variety of different reasons. I think that nonprofits were hit after the kind of financial crisis in 2008. Many nonprofits had a little bit of a delay before they really start to feel the effect of that. And so, you know, part of it's economic. Part of it is people being confused by our transition. And what is a collaborative leadership team? And what is the organization doing? So I think that, yes, part of it will be clarifying, you know, what's our structure, what are our goals, and how we're going to move forward. And I think the other part of what we're going to be doing is attracting new people to the organization. I think that there are folks that maybe used to participate in El Pueblo either as volunteers, donating time and money, who are might be excited to come back at this point, but there's also a lot of new people coming in, and we need that new energy and new ideas to help us grow.
Give us a sense of how that might work. You know, you compared it to, say, the ACLU. This is a group with a legal mission. It's made up of lawyers. They know how to put any social issue in terms of a legal contest and then take it to court. You're talking about something much different, a grassroots organization that builds community, that allows people to sort of associate with each other freely and openly, and then taking that and turning that into some kind of advocacy. How does that work? You get people to come, show up to the clinic or the youth organization, and then at some point you got to get to the legislature.
Right. And I think that it's a combination of factors, right? So it's not going to be purely one or the other. It's not going to be purely all of our ideas are coming from our health promoters or our youth program participants, because they might not have all the information to understand what's happening on a policy level that's impacting what they're seeing in the day-to-day in their community. So I think it's got to be a combination effort. One, we have to shore up our health promoters program, our youth program, to make sure that we're bringing in new people and that those people are driving the way that the program develops, right? So it's not just, here's our program, you can come in and participate in it, and the staff has it all worked out, but rather that there's a process for evaluation, making recommendations, and for modifying and growing the programs in a productive way. At the same time, we do need to maintain those relationships with other organizations that have more access to policy expertise, whether it's here locally or connecting with some of the national groups that are doing great work on immigration, to make sure we have that information exchange going back and forth, so that when community members are making decisions about what issues they want to focus on, they have that information.
I want to find out more about how you came to this this job and your ideas about social activism. You grew up in upstate New York, the daughter of Cuban immigrants, right? Mm-hmm. Tell us about that experience in Schenectady.
So when I was younger growing up, the area that we were living in was very much dominated by white folks, right? There were very few people of color in the community I grew up in, especially the neighborhood. And so I remember growing up and feeling a strong sense of difference, like that my family was different from other families, and really being embarrassed about, not wanting to learn Spanish, feeling a lot of wanting to be like the other kids, right? Which I think is fairly normal that young people experience. I think that my oldest brother, when he first went to school, was actually bilingual and had a lot of problems. And after that, my parents really made an effort for English to be the language of our household, really to the detriment of our Spanish. So for me, growing up, I didn't end up learning Spanish until I got much older. I could always understand it, but speaking it was always a challenge, in part because I was very stubborn and didn't want to do it, and in part just because of the area that we grew up in. So when I moved to South Carolina and saw the real segregation, that I was living in upstate New York, but I didn't see it because there wasn't a disenfranchised group right next to the community that we were in, it really opened my eyes to how I felt about myself, having always felt different, and then having people see me as white and really identifying with some of the experiences that some of my African-American classmates had had. So it's been a constant point of interest for me and kind of struggle, thinking about how we build bridges across race and class.
Well, it sounds like, if I may characterize this, and correct me if I'm wrong, so growing up the first 14 years, you felt that difference, but essentially wanted to escape that as soon as you could, mm-hmm. then got down to South Carolina, saw this phenomenon of segregation, found yourself arbitrarily cast as white, mm-hmm. which gave you a certain amount of privilege, I would guess, over and against the black population. at that point you became you wanted to become engaged.
Right. I think because I felt when I was young and growing up, I felt like there was something wrong, but I didn't understand enough what it was. When I got to South Carolina, I'm like, oh, this is very clear. Racism is wrong. And then I wanted to figure out, you know, ways that I could work on that.
We'll find out some of those ways when my conversation with Angeline Echevarria continues. She's the new executive director of El Pueblo. And you're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. I'm talking with Angeline Echevarria. She is the new executive director of El Pueblo, a Latina and Latino advocacy organization here in Durham. So you talked about, and for the entire state of North Carolina, going to South Carolina, experiencing racism, seeing your story in upstate New York as part of a much broader picture. So what did you do? Did you become active right away?
So it took me a while to figure out what I could do. I luckily happened upon a chapter of Amnesty International in Greenville, South Carolina, where I was going to school. And that really helped me to broaden my vision. I mean, at the time, you know, Amnesty International was only focusing on stuff happening in other countries. But it was my first time getting together with a group of people that was trying to change things. And that was a really formative experience for me. Through that, I actually ended up connecting with the South Carolina Progressive Network and other folks that were working on efforts to change things locally in South Carolina, not only focused on the international vision.
Were you aware at the time that there are certainly political prisoners here in the United States and that much of what Amnesty International does could easily be focused on the way we do things here?
I think that as I got involved, I learned about different things. There was a group in Greenville that was working on police brutality issues. And so I began to learn more about the structures and systems, and especially just the particulars of some of the history in the South. And that was really eye-opening for me. You know, at first with Amnesty International, I felt like, oh, you have to focus externally and things like that. But actually, as I grew within the organization and just participated in different events, at one point, Amnesty actually launched their USA campaign. And so that was, for me, it was like, oh, it's all coming together, you know.
Well, what did your parents think about all this?
You know, my parents have been very apolitical, generally. A lot of folks have stereotypes about Cuban immigrants being very staunchly anti-Castro. And I can't say that my parents were very passionately in that way, although they did come with that wave of immigrants that have sort of tend to be more Republican, tend to be more conservative, especially on economic issues. So I feel like they kind of let me do my thing, you know, all right, that's what you want to do. That's fine. And I was always so passionate about it that I think that they wouldn't feel comfortable kind of telling me, no, you can't do that. They definitely don't understand my passion at times, you know, because they actually, being Cuban immigrants, where Cuban immigrants are actually, you know, the red carpet is kind of laid out for Cuban immigrants when they come to this country. So don't necessarily have the personal connection to other immigrants who are experiencing the actual opposite of what they experienced when they came. And just not understanding, having kind of, you know, moved to these suburban areas and being somewhat disconnected from the struggles that I have thrown myself into and wanted to be a part of.
You were, you may have lived in a more isolated or suburban area. Is that what you did in South Carolina? Was
yes.
That kind of a suburban? But you went to a magnet school that was predominantly black, right?
Yes, that's true.
And what was your experience there?
That was one of the experiences that most helped me to see my own privilege, because the way that the program was set up is that the school, what I understood, what I was told when I was there, was that the school was in danger of being closed because it was too segregated. It was too overwhelmingly black, and it didn't meet the standards for integration. So when there were white schools that were in that situation, they would just bus African-American kids over, you know, an hour to go integrate these schools. Whereas when it was a black school that was overly segregated, they started a nice magnet program, right, where, you know, you could take these advanced courses and it would attract white and a lot of Asian students as well to to take those courses.
But
right?
They wouldn't bus them. They wouldn't force them on.
They wouldn't force them. Right. You would have to apply. It would be an honor. And then you would go and you'd take classes that were completely segregated from the general student body.
And so this was the case in your school, and apparently it didn't work. It was a magnet school, wasn't it? It was, or was it?
Well, so it was a magnet program within a regular public school.
I see.
Yeah, so it was the two tracks. That was what made it feel so staunchly divided, the two tracks of programming and coursework running kind of on parallel tracks but not crossing.
I see. So eventually you majored in, when you went to college, you majored in Latin American studies?
That's correct.
And what was behind that? What were you thinking there?
I think that at the time, well, when I went into college, I actually just started taking classes that interested me and then later tried to figure out what major that would fit in. And when I came to college, that was when I really decided that I wanted to learn Spanish. I wanted to be more connected to both my parents' experience, but also other folks in the community who had immigrant experiences. And so I started taking a bunch of literature classes, history, social studies. And when I tried to figure out what kind of major that fit into, it fit into Latin American studies.
You interned with Student Action with Farm Workers here in North Carolina, right?
Yes,
I did. So tell us about that. What did you do?
So when I applied to intern with SAF, I was only interested in doing organizing. So they don't actually tell you what your placement is going to be when they accept you into the program. But I remember being like, if I don't get an organizing placement, I'm not going to do the program.
You want to be the boss, apparently.
Yeah, okay. Apparently. Yeah. And so I was lucky because I was placed with the Farm Labor Organizing Committee. And that was my first time, one, working with agricultural workers, two, working in a union organizing setting or workers' rights setting, and three, speaking Spanish with people that I wasn't related to.
Wow.
And actually integrating that into my work, which was a big challenge.
Was it strange for you? Yeah, because you early in your life, you ran away from the language. You didn't really learn it that well. And now, one, you're going to be busted. You don't know it that well.
Right.
And two, here you are speaking it.
Well, I was definitely busted.
Yeah.
And it was a great experience for me. I mean, one thing that I love about SAF is that they really bring together a diverse group of students. So I got to connect with both students from here from the Carolinas, as well as students from all over the country who had either done farm work or their families had been involved in farm work. And so I was able to connect and really meet people that had a very different life experience that I did, but that were interested in social justice or were interested at the very least in helping other people, social work, you know what I mean? So that was wonderful for me. I mean, getting to talk to workers about their rights, seeing what it takes for a farm worker who might be, say, on an H-2A visa and have no other chance.
It's a guest worker, so they're here legally.
Right. So we spoke with workers of all statuses. But in terms of the workers that were guest workers, the risk that they would take by signing up and saying that they wanted to defend their rights in the workplace was really steep because their visas were only to work with one employer. So basically, if they lost that relationship, they would lose their legal status.
And there are plenty of other people to fill that because there are a lot more workers than there are visas. So so you're at great risk. So what did you learn? And what was your situation? Are you actually living in the same situation? Are you living and working with farm workers? Are you visiting? How did it work?
No. So they set us up in housing. I shared with one other student that was also placed at FLOC. And then we would go to
And FLOC is a different organization.
FLOC
right?
is a Farm Labor Organizing right. Committee. So the way that Student Action with Farm Workers works is that they place students with farm worker service organizations throughout the Carolinas. And so my placement was with FLOC. So I worked directly with FLOC staff. And we would go visit farm workers at different labor camps, talk to them about the union. At the time, we were organizing cucumber workers specifically because it was the time of the Mount Olive pickle boycott. And so I got to learn about, you know, how the workers were living, see the housing conditions, the working conditions, the way that the work is paid for, that it was on a piece rate system versus getting a certain hourly rate, and how that makes it very confusing for workers to be sure that they're being paid the minimum wage or to be able to demand payment for work rendered when someone else is keeping track of your production.
And
basically,
you're not really in a position to challenge their authority in terms of the county. Mm-hmm. What was that like? And I'd like you to talk about what you found similar and dissimilar in working in the agricultural sector. You'd been aware of these disparities now and, you know, sort of the advantages you had and your privilege. But this is now farm work. This isn't the kind of urban disparity that you'd seen before. Mm-hmm. What was the same about it, and how was it different?
I think that what was the same about it was that people oftentimes felt like they could not challenge some of the systems that are in place and that are affecting their lives in negative ways. I think that what was really different is the isolation in the rural areas, the way that farm work especially, oftentimes your housing is also dependent on your employer. So your housing, your transportation, your access to food, everything in the work that everything in your life when you're working at that place is dependent on your employer. And that is just a relationship that lends itself to abuse and exploitation.
And I think people would be surprised to know how little the employer is obligated to provide for the people who put food on our table.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, maybe you can give us a sense of just, you know, some of the ratios, how many beds per square foot and how much or how little water needs to be provided, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's a couple different factors, right? So there are certain regulations set up, especially for guest workers. I think that when you're talking about workers that are undocumented or living in kind of less formal relationships, it's even more difficult to identify what the regulations are and how the employer should be held accountable. In terms of guest workers, I mean, there are regulations in terms of how much space between bunk beds and how close can the kitchen area be to where beds are. What I found both when I worked here in North Carolina and then later when I worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center and traveled throughout the Southeast was that even when those regulations are in place, there's not anybody checking up with the employers to make sure that they're doing that. I mean, there is a system for inspections, but the agencies are always, in every state that I visited, overwhelmed and can't possibly cover the number of work sites that are active, especially during peak harvest season. So I think that that's the other factor. Yes, there are regulations in place. On one hand, they do provide some level of protection, but on the other hand, unless someone's enforcing those regulations, right, they don't really mean much for the average worker.
And as you pointed out, there's no way on earth that you're going to file a complaint if you're one of those workers. So it's got to be up to the agency to come in and make the inspection. You're not going to make a phone call.
Right. And so that's why a lot of legal service organizations have outreach programs. So like at the Southern Poverty Law Center, I was an outreach paralegal. So I would go out and we would, you know, map different camps and go visit the workers to educate them about their rights. And I think that those programs are too few and too far between, of course, and are always overwhelmed by how do you prioritize when, I mean, do you look where the situation's the worst or where the employer owns more work sites so that you could have a broader impact? I mean, it's really a challenge to address those concerns.
Well, how did you feel after that program? I mean, it could be overwhelming and terribly frustrating to say, yeah, I figured it out. There's really nothing we can do. That's what I've learned this summer. Mm-hmm. I mean, was it that? Did you have a sense that there was something valuable and productive about what you did and what you could do as an advocate?
I think that SAF does a really good job of supporting students as they are going through this process over the summer. I mean, they had different workshops and trainings for us and also, a closing retreat. They provide space for reflection and also tools for folks when they get back to their college campuses to be able to, have events for Farm Worker Awareness Week and connect to other organizations and things like that, whereby you can continue to stay involved and not just be like, wow, the situation's really hopeless.
And bringing in the outside world, the rest of us, into that world can be valuable. You talked about the Mount Olive Pickle campaign. Remind us about that campaign, mm-hmm, and how it ended.
So the campaign was basically to get a contract for the cucumber workers that pick the cucumbers that eventually turn into Mount Olive pickles. And as I understand, it was eventually won. This was, you know, long after I had came and gone from North Carolina. But I understand that Flock continues to organize here in the state and is continuing to defend that contract.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, they did the unthinkable. They got the pickle company to charge to pay more for cucumbers. So this is us saying that we're going to pay more for our jars of Mount Olive on purpose. We're going to sacrifice some of our privilege mm-hmm. to have a low-priced pickle on at the expense of and on the backs of the workers who are doing this. We're going to give up that privilege, pay more. And the company said, yep, we're going to pay more for cucumbers. And that was after a very successful, I think, about a five-year boycott.
Right.
So people had to be aware. They had to say, we're not buying them until you raise the price on us.
Mm-hmm.
And when you do that, then everything. A little bit like what you did. You'd notice your privilege and say, I need to do something about
it. Right. And I think that it was a very good example of the combination of community advocate pressure on the company, as well as the workers being organized on their own behalf. So that combination, I think, really makes a successful campaign.
You went to Little Rock, Arkansas, worked on the Women's Project. What was mm-hmm. that?
So the Women's Project is a social justice organization based on the intersections of oppressions, right? So looking not just as how, as a woman of color, racism might affect you, but how might homophobia affect you, right? Even if you're a straight woman, how does that affect you? And so it was a really exciting place to work. I think it was very challenging to translate the ambition of the mission into the concrete actions that we take on the everyday to move forward.
What did you learn from that experience?
I learned a lot about solidarity. I think that one of the campaigns that we were working on was to get restorative hate crimes legislation. So legislation not that would enhance penalties, because we were recognizing that, you know, folks were being pushed into the prison industrial complex. So we were looking for the penalties, or the if it's identified as a hate crime, that instead of, you know, longer prison sentences, they would have to do something to restore the dignity of the community that they had attacked by committing a hate crime. At the time that I was living there, it didn't pass, in part because they wanted us to strip the protections for LGBT community members. And one thing that was really inspiring was that the Legislative Black Caucus said no in the state legislature. And so seeing that solidarity of people of color with the gay and lesbian community was really inspiring, knowing that even though we lost this battle, in order to win more long-term progressive social change, we had to stand that line and stand together.
We are seeing more and more of that. The NAACP in this state lined up firmly against Amendment 1, seeing it as a civil rights issue, and seeing, you know, our civil rights all being eroded by that amendment. These kinds of coalitions may have been unthinkable 10 or 15 years ago. And also coalitions, talk about El Pueblo's relationship with the NAACP, because there are tense relationships in some communities between Latinos and African Americans. Talk about that relationship and how you see your collaboration with the NAACP.
Right. Well, so I'm new coming in yet. I haven't met with anyone from the NAACP. I understand that in the past we've worked together closely, and that there's been a lot of support both from the NAACP on some of the issues that El Pueblo has worked on, and on the part of El Pueblo on some of the issues that the NAACP has identified as a priority. And that type of collaboration and solidarity is something that I would seek to further under my leadership.
The leadership of Angeline Echevarria, who is the new director of El Pueblo in North Carolina. And after a short break, we're going to get her thoughts on some of the issues facing Latinos in America and here in North Carolina. Stay tuned to The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Angeline Echevarria, new executive director of the Latino advocacy group El Pueblo. So we talked about your work in Little Rock, and then you also became a member of and started working for the Southern Poverty Law Center. What kind of work did you do there?
So that's where I was an outreach paralegal working on their immigrant justice project. So that was the job that gave me the opportunity to travel throughout the Southeast talking to immigrant workers about their rights. It was another job that focused mostly on farm workers. We represented a lot of pine planters, and we would go around, tell them about their legal rights. We had, you know, outreach booklets and materials. We had a 1-800 number that they could call to get information. And then I supported the attorneys that were filing class action lawsuits against abusive employers.
What about La Fuente? You went to New York, back to New York,
right.
Now with a group called La Fuente. Talk about their focus.
So La Fuente has a unique model for organizing. We worked very closely with union members, but in the neighborhoods that they lived in. So we had neighborhood-based committees that would work on campaigns, both at the very local neighborhood level. It might be getting a park fixed up or things like that. And then they would connect to broader campaigns for social justice, mostly relating to immigrants' rights and public education reform.
So what brought you back to North Carolina and El Pueblo? Is this something you've been looking to do?
Yes. So when I decided to move to New York, New Jersey, I was living in New Jersey and working in New York. It was for both personal and professional reasons. One is that, you know, leaving the Southern Poverty Law Center, I wanted to explore work with community-based organizations in an area where there was more of a progressive infrastructure and where immigrant communities have already achieved at least a certain level of political power, so I could get a feel for what that looked like. My second priority was very personal. My grandmother was getting on in years, and I wanted to spend more time with her before she passed away. So I worked in New York City and on Long Island for 4 years, and I learned a lot during that time. It was great because, on the one hand, I was able to learn from organizations that have really won a lot and really, you know, kind of at the forefront of kind of progressive activism. On the other hand, I got to learn that they're facing a lot of the same challenges. It's on a different scale, but organizing is organizing. And, you know, there's always challenges when working in coalitions. There's always challenges of getting grassroots community members to the point where they can engage and feel motivated and like it's worth their time to invest in social change. And so after a while, I was ready to come back to the South and bring what I had learned in the city back to good use down here.
How much of that is transferable? You talked about there being kind of an infrastructure. There are unions up there. There are some political power within Latino communities. Can you transfer that to a place that is so unfriendly to labor as North Carolina is?
I think that there are some things you can transfer and some things that you can't. I think that one thing that was helpful to me was realizing that everything that people had gained in New York, every victory for working class people or immigrant communities, was something that was fought for. And, you know, we're at a different stage in our development of the community here in North Carolina in terms of, you know, numbers, what types of access to political representation is reasonable to expect. And so I think that bringing some of that knowledge and skills and also just some of those connections, right? Because I think that even though there are groups in New York that are working really locally, a lot of them have a vision for broader social change. If we are talking about passing legislation, it's actually more strategic to work in North Carolina than maybe in New York, where you have a lot of legislators who are already on your side.
Well, what about that? It seems to me that if you're talking about organizing and any kind of political clout, you have to have some kind of political status. And so for undocumented, those who are here without documentation, I mean, what are the challenges of even creating? Do you start with immigration reform, which sounds like a big order and a long haul?
I think that this is something that we struggle with a lot because on the one hand, immigration reform would totally change the conditions for the immigrant community here in North Carolina, right? So it would be a huge win. At the same time, if we were to magically get that tomorrow and we haven't organized on the ground for folks to even know what they would do if they had those rights, then it would be a pretty empty victory. So I think that we have to both ensure that we're reaching enough people and creating enough motivation and energy at the grassroots level where folks are getting information and skills that they can use to to represent themselves and fight for what they think is right for their communities, as well as analyzing kind of at the policy level what would be strategic in terms of investing our time and energy over the next couple of years.
What's your sense of the priorities for the needs for Latino communities here in North Carolina?
Mm-hmm. So I just moved back here a month ago. In my conversations with folks, I think that there's a lot of concerns in the community relating to policing, checkpoints, feeling unsafe, driving, the loss of driver's license a few years back really had a big impact here in North Carolina. So that's something I hear some of the community members talking about. Among the youth that we work with, I've heard a lot of them talking about access to higher education, undocumented students having to pay out-of-state tuition, and seeing a lot of barriers for their continuing their studies and getting the skills that, and information that they feel like they need to really be productive members of the community.
What is the, when you look at the Latino communities that you have seen here in North Carolina, how do they compare in terms of their cohesiveness and a sense of wanting to become politically engaged compared to places like New York and New Jersey?
I think that it's very different. I mean, a large percentage of the population here in North Carolina is Mexican. And I think that North Carolinians that are not of an immigrant background think of Mexican as like a monolithic group, but it's a huge country with a lot of diversity within the different states and the different communities. Some of the folks coming to North Carolina might be of an indigenous background and speak different languages than other folks who speak Spanish. So I think that in terms of cohesiveness, we definitely face some challenges. I think that in terms of the policies that are affecting folks, those kind of bring people together because it's like, oh, we're facing some of the same challenges, whether it's language access or whether it's the access to higher education or things that kind of bring people together across their individual experiences. In New York, it's just a totally different ballgame. I mean, you have immigrant communities that have been established for many, many years. You have Latinos that are, you know, elected officials and have built a really strong power base. And quite frankly, we have corrupt Latino elected officials in New York.
That's how you know you've arrived.
Right. Which presents its own kind of challenge because folks who have gotten engaged and gotten involved in the process, then they see one of, quote unquote, our own turning on the community, you know, being accused and convicted of corruption. And that really, really devastates folks. And it makes you feel like, why should I get engaged? So it presents its own challenge once you've, quote unquote, arrived.
I wonder if some of the things we see in other places are applicable here. You know, the Center for Constitutional Rights just turned out a report on the stop and frisk statistics in New York City, up 600%. The mm-hmm. stops, random stops on the street, up 600% since 2002, 203,000 in a year, 87% Black and Latino, mm-hmm. and 10% of those result in an arrest. So you're 10% of the people you stop, of the 200,000 people you stop, you actually got a ticket.
Right.
And 87% are Black and Latino. This is systematic racism. There's no other way to look at that. And I wonder if there's a sense that this is a pervasive problem or is it trouble in New York? This is New York's problem.
I think that there's a strong sense that this is a pervasive problem. I think that a lot of groups throughout the country are working at these issues, looking at how policing and the kind of the way that people of color are demonized and kind of seen as, you know, causers of crime is something that happens, I think, pretty consistently throughout the country. I think that the level of how extreme this has gotten in New York is in part because it's one prong of a really strong campaign of gentrification. Right. So they're really looking at how they can target certain communities so they can, quote unquote, clean up the city. And that's been something that's been happening for years up there. I think that in North Carolina, one of the parallels that we see is some of the policing practices that have targeted immigrant community members, checkpoints being set up in Latino neighborhoods to give people tickets for driving without a license, when everybody knows that if you're undocumented, you're not going to be able to have access to a license. So it's really just a way of punishing folks for being here. So I think that these are things that we're seeing all over the place, and that are really concerns and barriers to civic participation for communities of color.
Now, there are other sort of national issues that have a bearing on all communities. And I wonder if we look at just health care alone, how does that debate, the national health care debate, look from Latino communities?
I think that, well, one of the issues that we work a lot on at El Pueblo is health access, training community members to know how they can access the healthcare system, and also how they can just take steps to keep their families safe and prevent diseases in any way that's within their control. I think that in terms of access to healthcare, there's a lot of barriers, especially for undocumented immigrants, which we have a large population here in North Carolina. And that's something that I don't think that there are particularly easy solutions that we could just say, oh, we just have to do this quick campaign and we'll sort that out, right? Because I think that access to healthcare is a huge barrier for non-immigrant community members, you know, native North Carolinians that just can't afford it, and the programs that are out there don't really apply to them. So I think that it's something that gives us a possibility of working across communities, collaborating with other groups that are seeing similar concerns in their communities and their neighborhoods.
The young Latino population, of course, in North Carolina is expanding as well. How do you see them as part of your organization? What role do they play in all this?
So we right now are actually going through an evaluation process about how we integrate youth into all of El Pueblo, right? We have run youth-specific programming for years at the organization in different, you know, kind of with different topics and different focus. We recently had a youth forum where we created a steering committee of young people who planned it was basically a 2-day conference for young people from throughout the state. And they decided what topics they wanted to work on, which activities, and kind of ran the whole thing with support from staff. So right now we're doing this analysis to see, how can we become not just an adult organization that has some youth programming, but how do we really create a multi-generational organization where power and decision making is shared across the group? So it's something we're working on right now. I think it's really key to our future, not just because, oh, the young Latino population is growing so much, but also in terms of civic engagement, voter engagement. These are the pools of Latinos that are more likely to be eligible voters when they turn 18. And how are we preparing them for those responsibilities that come with citizenship?
It seems one of the challenges in that is, to getting back to your experience as a young woman, how much do you want to promote and nurture a sense of Latino identity? And how much of that is about assimilation and being part of the broader civic discourse?
I think it's a real balancing act, because on the one hand, if you don't provide a structure by which people feel proud of who they are, it's very hard to get them to take action in a way that is productive and they can really bring their whole selves to the work. I think that in addition to that, we want to provide enough information so that folks understand, what are the civic structures here? What is the General Assembly? How does it affect my life? And in order to have a balance of where people can bring their whole selves to the work and celebrate their identity, their culture, and all the things that might be important from their family roots, as well as the information that they need to be effective as they seek to engage in social change.
So what are I know you've only been here a month, but give us an idea if there are any upcoming events, conferences, activities from El Pueblo.
So we are having our Fiesta del Pueblo again this year. It's going to be on Sunday, September 9th. And that is this is very much a celebration of Latin culture. We have displays of all different countries from here in Latin America, bands, visual artists.
Where is that going to be?
That's going to be held in Moore Square in Raleigh, downtown Raleigh. If you want more information, you can visit our website, which is elpueblo.org. And In addition to that, we're going to be convening a lot of meetings with our youth program participants to do that evaluation that I was talking about.
Sounds great. What have you learned? You've been here a month. You've had some idea. You applied for the job and got it, so you must have known. What's been the big surprise for you? What have you learned just in the month that you've been here about this job?
I'm trying to think the big surprise. I think that I have been very pleasantly surprised by how strong an organization El Pueblo is, despite the long period of transition that they had before I came in. I'm really amazed by the way that the staff has really pulled together and worked as a team, even when there hasn't been necessarily a focus on how all the pieces of our work comes together. I think that the staff has come in and made that happen, as well as a lot of our program participants. So like folks that are participating in the health program that are really excited about their kids participating in the youth program. So that kind of integration and the strength of the organization has really been a pleasant surprise for me, despite all the challenges that we face.
Angeline, good luck. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Angeline Echeverria is the new executive director of the Latino advocacy organization El Pueblo. For more information, go to elpueblo.org. Our website is stateofthings.org, and The State of Things is produced by Alex Granados and Sean Wen. Dixon Cruz and Sarah Edwards are our interns. Robin Copley is our technical director. Al Budarski is sitting in today. Managing editor Lindsay Foster Thomas. Susan Davis is our senior producer. And this is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.